vilification of the mythological soul of America has been happening for quite a few years. It was the imagination of Walt Disney that he would create a place, a universe full of the sort of stories that drive the childlike wonder with which adults should see the world, even going so far as to create their own city outside of Orlando in Florida called Celebration. Interesting and fascinating book written about that in the late 90s. And there's been criticism of the Disneyfication of everything from Times Square to the role of that consciousness in America itself. There's the current presidential regime who sort of rails against this multicultural plurality vision of the world where everybody is kind to themselves, and then perhaps approaching the current administration as a more historically accurate one, where the people in power tend to be the ruthless, cruel, and inhumane, and using brute force and riches to sort of fund a barbaric mentality. And so what Disney does really well is they are able to turn everything into a place that perhaps resonates more with children who have yet to see the horrors of the world, and adults who want to recapture a vision of, say, for example, Adventureland, devoid of the horrors of genocide of American Indians, so you can enjoy the Alamo and Davy Crockett without experiencing what Disney later attempted to make up for by creating the film Pocahontas. But so they've been embroiled in controversy because it's hard to tell a happy history, because history, of course, is written by victors, and when they retell the tale, they tend to undersell the part of the vanquished. So the Beauty and the Beast movie, it represents part of what Disney's been doing the last few years by mining creative content in such a way as to perpetually mint from it. What they did by purchasing the Star Wars movies from Lucas, the content there, and then reproducing a sort of Star Wars movies every few years and then a Star Wars theme park. They've always been doing this. In fact, when they first were releasing movies onto VHS, they were smart enough to sort of limit the release of Disney movies so that you couldn't rent them at the Blockbuster Video or wherever you rented movies, whenever that was a thing. You had to wait, and then Disney would re-release them in theaters. If you grew up in the 80s and 90s, you saw Bambi and Dumbo in the movie theater, even though they'd been out for years and years. And by doing this, Disney controls the way that you see its product, and it controls the ability of its product to retain a sense of special, limited access with which audiences respond well to. That's to say, they've been doing this well for a long time. So when they eventually did release their films onto video and stuff, you had to purchase them. You couldn't rent them. And now that you can rent them, you have to do it through Disney's own app that they control and that they own. So they are sort of the Marxist vision of the owner controlled, or the capitalist production source where the worker sort of controls partially what he works on. Now there's been some reports of the conditions at Disneyland by the people who work in the animal suits, so that's maybe not a great example. But let's get back to Beauty and the Beast for a second, and let's say that what Disney's been doing by recreating films based on the content that they already own the rights to, like the Jungle Book animated movie that they made into a feature film, like the Pete's Dragon one that they made into a feature. So if they go live action and they turn all of their animated beloved films into live action films, if they take Lion King, if they turn that into a live action film in addition to a play, in addition to a theme park, they can do something that very few studios and companies can do, which is to take something that's actually really good and then make it, reproduce it for, in a Walter Benjamin sort of way for the masses, so where you're no longer thinking about it as art, but you kind of experience it as part of the world that you live in, and you accept that. And Star Wars is no longer a story that someone made up with and wrote. There's the idea that there was a writer for the Star Wars movies, even though Lawrence Kasdan wrote Empire Strikes Back and wrote The Big Chill. And so he's a talented writer, but you don't think of it as a Lawrence Kasdan written movie. You kind of accept that Jabba the Hutt freezing Han Solo is part of the, has been part of history and always will be part of history. And so in that way, by Emma Watson taking the role of Beauty in the live-action Beauty and the Beast, as opposed to it being Emma Stone who took the part in La La Land after Emma Watson turned it down. And now Emma Stone has an Oscar, but Emma Watson perhaps has something more valuable, which is she will always be known as the princess from Beauty and the Beast, and she'll always be Beauty, and what Hollywood actor would not want to be synonymous with the word beauty. And in such a beautiful movie, such a it's sort of a British retelling. You got Emma, besides Emma Watson, you also have Ian McKellen, you also have Emma Thompson, you also have James McAvoy. You just have a lot of the great current British actors, and perhaps if Kenneth Branagh hadn't divorced Emma Thompson, he would have been in it as well. But let's just say that this is a beautiful movie. The CGI does similar to things that what it did in Jungle Book, which is to say it delights the heart and opens up the spirit, and it's a great movie. The singing is integrated very much like La La Land into the plot of the movie, and the sort of horror of skin-deep perception versus inner beauty is at the heart of one of Disney's mission statements, which is to create empathy and plurality among all of the diverse participants in the United States of Disney. And whether it remains the United States of Disney or reverts to the barbaric tribes that are currently in politics remains to be seen. But for two glorious hours, Beauty and the Beast takes you there.